Welcome to the Wish I'd Known Then podcast. I'm Sarah Rosette.
And I'm Jamie Albright. And this week on the show, we have
Becca Syme.
Yes, we do. We
love talking to Becca.
We love talking to Becca. Becca was our first guest. She has been on the podcast a couple of times now, but we haven't had her on since 2021.
It's been a while. She really helped us get started and figure out a lot of things about the podcast. So it's great to catch up with her. And she has a Kickstarter going on, and we talked about that and a lot about fear and high stakes in dealing with change and burnout. Just great tips on mindset stuff, on how to handle everything that's happening, you know, and not go crazy.
Exactly. I mean, she still, this Kickstarter's about, writer, you still need to quit, because her quit cast all started because of the book she wrote in, writer, you need to quit, or something to that.
Dear writer, you need to quit. Yeah.
She just, and she talks about her journey through burnout and what she's learned on the other side.
And the changes she's making in her business. And she's very futuristic. And we talk about the future of publishing and what she sees and why she's hopeful, which was a very nice discussion to have. I enjoyed that part, especially.
Yeah, I did too. So what's been going on with you?
So I'm working on the letters launch. Mm-hmm. So I'm doing some autoresponders. I'm going to run some ads, getting all those things.
Yeah.
Put together. The book launched this week. Today's, we're recording this on October 23rd. My most recent book launched on Tuesday in among all the AWS drama of outages and things, which it went out on Tuesday or Monday. It went out Monday.
Monday, yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm so glad I did the release on my store first, because I guess if it falls apart, it's okay. But it didn't. I mean, it did fine. It launched and I had pre-orders and it was all fine. And so that was all good. But I took some time this week. We talked about this in the interview. I took some time to celebrate the 34th book.
Wow.
And it was fun. And now I'm working on the letters and it's busy, busy. And we're getting ready to go to Author Nation. So doing a couple of things for that.
Yeah.
And looking forward to seeing everybody.
I know. I'm looking forward to it as well. I am just writing today. Lord willing, I got to do a newsletter, but I think I'm going to do it tonight while I watch my shows. But today I'm going through the last chapter of this book for the second revision.
That's good.
It's the hardest one. So I've sort of put it off this morning, and I didn't go to Starbucks. I just figure if I'm going to really cry, I just need to be in a private place, not in public. It was really hard. The first time going through it, this time will be even harder. So I will finish that. I've got to go back and fix a couple of things at the beginning, because I started writing it first past and then decided about five chapters in I was going to do first present. So I didn't go back. I just kept going. And so I got to go fix that. And then it will go to the developmental editor next week and we will see what she says. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it is exciting. I've been thinking about just some things that, you know, for launch, I still do not have a very clear idea of what a launch, like when the launch would be, because I really need to hear back from her to see how much work has to be done. I mean, I know it's got to have some work done, but if it's a total overhaul, then that's something different. So I'm just sort of wait. I'm not making any decisions until after I hear back from her. Anyway,
well, that is good. Mm-hmm. It's good to be at this point, right?
It is good to be at this point. I feel like I'm a long way from launch. But then again, when I think about where I was April the 18th of this year, when I hadn't written anything, I'm like, well, because I started writing it on April 19th, I've come a pretty long way. So that's, I'm just trying to look at the positive. So,
yeah, I think you should. I think that's a great way to look at it, because
thank you.
You had no book and now you have a book.
That's right.
I have a book. It's in draft, but that's fine.
It's in draft.
So that's good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah. We don't have any new supporters this week, but we do have a new supporter episode out about symbolism. And we learned that they've changed things up and the supporter episodes would show up in the feed and now they don't. So we did a little clip highlight reel to let y'all know what's in there and to let you know it's out. So there's more than that. If you become a supporter, you would get access to that episode plus all the other episodes that we've done for supporters.
Right.
So if you want to support the podcast, you can go to wishidknownforwriters.com/support. And we just appreciate everyone. We are thankful to have y'all as supporters.
We really thank you so much. And we should probably get on with the episode because it's really great.
Yes. So here is Becca. Today, we're really excited to have Becca Syme here. Hi, Becca. How are you?
I'm so excited to be back. This is one of my favorite podcasts to be on. So I'm so glad you guys said it. I could be on here.
So we're very excited to have you. We're going to let Sarah refresh people as to who you are. Like you need much of an interview. Yeah. But we'll do that.
Becca Syme is the Gallup Certified Strengths Coach and has individually coached more than 6,000 authors at all levels. She's the author of the Quit Books for Writers series and the popular Write Better, Faster course, and the host of the QuitCast for Writers podcast and YouTube channel. She also writes mystery novels and lives on one of the Thousand Lakes in Minnesota.
I do.
And it's beautiful there.
Oh my gosh. Love,
we went last year to Minnesota and I was just struck by how pretty it was.
Yeah. And you all came at the best time, which is October. And it is absolutely the peak excellence of life to be in Minnesota in October. So
yeah. It really is. So give us an update on what's happened since you were last on the podcast in 2021. How is that possible?
Yeah, well, I burned out pretty hardcore, and that's probably has something to do with it. I kind of disappeared from public life a little bit, just trying to recover and had some, you know, personal stuff going on as well. So I feel like everyone in the author community probably can identify with this, burnout experience. And throughout the process of burning out was continuing to still just coach like a mad person because I need to do that, right? Like I need to continue to work. And so I didn't really have a chance to recover well until this last like spring, really. So I feel like I finally am out of the burnout pit. And when I came out of the burnout pit and sort of looked around and realized like, oh, it's been a long time. Like it's been a long time that I've been doing this and things are really different now. And so we kind of need to change the conversation that we're having around the BFA. And so I was like, okay, let's really nail this sustainability stuff. And that's kind of been my goal for a while. Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. It's the B word, burnout. And I don't mean just burnout. It's hard. It's hard.
Yeah, it's so hard. Oh. It's hard. And you usually can't just stop, you know, like there.
No, you got to pay your bills. Yeah.
You got to pay bills. And for most of us, the things that are putting us into burnout don't go away just because we burn out. And so it's a very difficult process to deal with those ongoing drains of your energy and to figure out what of them you can actually leave behind and what you can't. And sometimes it can take a really long time.
Yeah. Well, this kind of leads into the next question. What's the most important lesson you've learned recently? So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, I know that you've had a lot going on.
Yeah. The most important lesson I learned recently is if you don't just accept reality, it's going to come for you. And I feel like this about things that we all are familiar with experiencing, right? When things are rough and difficult and I don't want them to be, when things change and I don't want them to change, there is an element of grief that we have to go through in the transition process, right? Of learning how to deal with things being different. But the longer I stay in that space, the more I'm keeping myself from moving forward. And I think a lot of I just didn't want to have to give up this experience that I was having of being able to help people at that volume individually.
Yeah.
And so transitioning away from being quite so available on an individual basis has been really hard for me. And I have learned that there just are limitations to our human experience and that pretending like there aren't limitations is only going to make life more difficult for us. So I feel like I've learned a lot about acceptance in the last couple of years and acceptance on a lot of levels. And it's helped me to become more autonomous as well, I think, which has been really helpful. So I feel like my main learning has been there are things you can't change. And wishing that they weren't that way is not as helpful as we think it is.
It's not a good strategy. No. Not a good strategy. So explain what you mean by more autonomous.
So I feel like a lot of my decision making was reliant on what other people wanted, like either, you know, my family to a certain extent, the people around me, definitely the people in my community. And I wasn't making decisions that had my own best interests at heart. Like I wasn't setting boundaries effectively. I was really enmeshed with a lot of my, you guys have had Claire Taylor around, you know what I mean? Like we're all familiar with Enneagram, but I was really enmeshed in this fear that's at the core of who I am as a person about my value and my and my presence in and the need for me, right? The desire for my presence and the need for me. And it was running so many of the choices that I was making. And so in learning how to allow people to be disappointed and allow people to be mad at me, it was learning that there is a benefit to people being disappointed in you, to people having a negative opinion of you, to people being frustrated or disappointed, because it means that I'm not self-abandoning, which is my tendency is to just not set the boundary, not say no, you know, like just so learning how to be more self-centered was really the trajectory.
And would you say there are any other mindset shifts you've had to make?
Yes, I feel like I've had to make so many. I had to be okay with what would happen if my business income went down. And for those of you who don't know, like I run a seven-figure business. I have 14 people at the time that were working for or with me, and where I was responsible for a lot of people's, like I was responsible for a lot of people's income. And I had to go through this time period where I was like, if this doesn't continue, and if my not royalties is a different word, but I use royalties because authors are familiar with it, right? Like if my royalties go down, and I have to change the way that I'm living and change how my business functions, there are other people who are going to be impacted. And I was continuing to not make good self-centered decisions because I was trying to protect other people. And and so the acceptance of, you know, there are things that are actually better when I run a more streamlined, more self enterprise for myself. There are things that are better about how I can serve authors. There are things that are better, right? So there's a lot of stuff that is actually really beneficial about that. But I really had to face that change and the pain of what's going to happen when things don't stay the way that they were, even though I would have preferred us to be in the gold rush for forever and to stay in that space for forever, you know?
Well, so you mentioned beneficial. I just thinking about that word and streamlining. So I think we have a tendency to overcomplicate things and make things way more busy and complicated than they need to be. So can you talk a little bit about how you streamline maybe your business and maybe anything you learned from that that would help other people who want to do that?
Rather than thinking about what the job was to be done, right? Like what would, if I could do this job at its peak, it's like it would take so many people to do. And then it requires me to be the manager of all those things and also the content creator and also the coach and also the business owner, right? It just required so much of me. And if I instead looked at what do I have to give and then what can I fit into those slots, right? So I'm not a great manager of people when I'm also the business owner. If all I'm doing is managing, I'm fine. But when I'm the business owner and content creator, then the management of my staff was getting put off. And I was, and we were really struggling with how to effectively manage all the work. And so I can't offer everything that I used to be able to offer. And I had to sort of go through this process of looking at what is the most important for me, given how many hours I can give. And these things are not as important, and these things are. And so even though I would prefer to continue to do everything, I can't because there's only so much of me and my capacity to go around. And so as much as I wish that I could do everything and it would be fun and nice if I could do everything, also, I don't want this job to kill me. Like, I don't want this job to cost me anything that it doesn't need to cost me. I want the job to bring joy to my life as well. And I am at my most joyful when I am writing and when I am content producing and when I'm with my people. And so I just had to decide, like, what can I afford to give? And then how do we transition the business financially? And then also from a perspective of what are the hours that I can afford and what's it going to cost me? How do I get myself to that ideal space down the road? And it's going to be a long process. It's going to be like a year process, but my business already looks completely different than it did a year ago. And it's going to look completely different again a year from now. And I mean, I'm excited about it. Like I want the business to continue to change, but it's also sad, right? Because I don't get to do what I used to do.
Yeah. And there is some grief with giving things up, but you know, you said your business will look different next year than it does now. And even if you weren't making all these changes strategically, it would still look different next year anyway, right?
If I don't make the strategic decisions, the decisions are going to come for me. This is kind of what I meant about the when I said previously, like there's only so much that I can choose when my energy is in play, because I have a limited amount of time and energy, and that continual burnout that I was facing, right, where probably once a year I would just hit this burnout space, and then it just got worse and worse every time until I would face the reality of it. And it was like I could see my capacity waning over time, futuristic and strategic, right? I could see it coming, and I just kept thinking, I'm never going to be able to outpace this. Like I am always, it is going to happen at one point or another. And I don't want it to happen catastrophically. I want it to happen because I choose and have some agency, and I want to pick what I keep, and I want to continue to write and do, you know, so it is, it's been a lot of change, but it definitely, it's going to change no matter what, like you said, right? It's going to come for me.
How do you view mistakes, and how do you recover when things go wrong?
Yeah, I have enough 3 Enneagram in me that I don't like mistakes. Like I don't love mistakes.
Me either.
Yeah, I don't know very many people who love them, but I will say over the last year, and this is largely due to just being friends with and being coached by Claire, that consistent reminder that like a lot of the way that I feel about mistakes is because of my fear, right? And it isn't actually that mistakes are bad. It's that I'm afraid of what might happen, quote unquote, right? So the nebulous fears are my enemy. The things that I'm afraid might happen if, et cetera, is my enemy. And so I think I have been more mistake friendly now than I used to be. And I would like to think that I can see a place in the future where I might even be pro mistake. Like I might even be excited about it, because I think that so in places where there's less high stakes, like right now for me in my fiction career, I'm letting myself just do whatever I want, because it's not paying enough of my bills right now that I have to worry about it. Like, oh, I won't be able to pay my bills next month if I change or do something different. So I'm just letting myself do whatever I want. And I've never been happier as a fiction writer.
That's great. Yeah.
Because I allow myself to do intuitively what's in me to do in that space. But it does require me to not have high stakes in that.
Yeah.
And I think that's the piece that a lot of us don't understand, is we're like, well, I want this to be fun. And I'm like, hold the phone though. When the stakes are high, it will not be fun. Fun and high stakes are the opposite of each other. People constantly think because they like roller coasters or they like skydiving or something that they like things that are high stakes. And I'm like, no, for you, jumping out of a plane is low stakes. You don't think you're going to die. But talk about your feelings, Kevin, and suddenly we're in high stakes territory. Like, you don't like that, but they think because they like things that everybody else thinks are dangerous. And I'm like, no, high stakes and fun can't coexist with each other. Yeah. When the stakes are too high, the fun goes away. When the stakes are low, the fun can come back again. Right. By the way, any of you who don't like feeling your feelings, you can actually have fun feeling your feelings if you will commit to lowering the stakes about what it means to have feelings and to be emotional. So just like those of us who are scared of jumping out of planes could have more fun doing it if we could conquer the fear there, right?
Yeah. But, yeah. There's a big difference between an adrenaline rush and high stakes, I think.
Huge difference.
They kind of feel the same sometimes, but there's a big difference there.
That's interesting because, you know, it's with this book I'm writing, it has been fun because the stakes as far as money and stuff like that are low because, you know, I'm not making any money now anyway. So what does it matter? But on the other hand, the stakes are high because it's a story that's really personal to me. And it's something I really, you know, I want it to do well. And not necessarily because I haven't had a book in a long, you know, not, it's not really egocentric. It's more, again, I've said this before, if they don't like the book, then they don't like my dead sister. Well, that feels really bad. So, you know, trying to take the pressure off that has been hard, but it's been weird because I am enjoying it. But then anytime those stakes, you know, I let myself wonder, how is this going to be received? What if people don't like it? All of them, then the joy goes away. It's just, it's very weird. It's so strange.
Yeah. It's funny because like, it's always the high stakes have a certain feel to them, right? Where it's like, oh boy, now it's not fun and games anymore. Like you can almost feel that, like what happens if feeling. And the same situation, let's say, you know, releasing the book or me failing or whatever, people's royalties going down, could be not worrisome if we could understand a bigger picture. So I think part of what I have been doing over the course of learning about failure is understanding that there's always a bigger picture whenever my brain is trying to narrow down and be very, very intentional about what happens if this one thing goes wrong. And it's almost like understanding that template of behavior in my brain helps me to recognize when I need to ride herd on it a little bit, right? When I need to say like, oh, we're getting too high stakesy about this situation. We probably need to lower the stakes a little bit. And then I have like, you know, emotional regulation stuff that I do. I will talk to friends, etc. But I can now feel that feeling that Jamie was talking about where, oh boy, I feel it now. Like, ooh, this matters a little too much. And I start to what if, and I start to extrapolate. Yeah. But yeah, for me, it's been all about recontextualizing by looking at the bigger picture. There is nothing that can happen in one moment that isn't death, right? There's nothing that can happen in one moment that's going to change my author career to a point where I cannot salvage it.
Right.
Like nothing, or my nonfiction business, or my podcast, or my, you know, what launch or whatever. There's nothing that can happen that will make it so that I can't make a good thing out of it or change, you know, like we get so focused on things going right that we don't realize you can change anything. Like you can recover from anything. It's just we get so narrowed. Like the stakes go up so high, we get so narrowed and we don't always know how to deconstruct it.
That's true. That is so true. I mean, I'm having this issue now with the title of this book. I had a title, but now I'm like, I think I need a different title because I want to change it. The title I had was sort of setting or season specific and I want to change it. And so I'm doing all this stuff and I felt myself getting really anxious. I'm like, it's just a title. It's not, a title is not going to make or break a book. A really horrible one will, but I'm not going to come up with a really horrible one. It will be the choice between good and maybe a little gooder. It's not going to be a bad title. So just let it go. Mm-hmm. And don't hang on to it so tightly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think we're going to switch gears a little bit. You coach a lot of authors. So what's the most common thing that authors say they wish they'd known when they finally book coaching with you?
Yeah, it's funny because I'm the person who says like, nobody has to do strengths, right? Like no one has to do it because I don't think that every single person in the entire world would benefit from it because there are some people who won't. But I will say there are so many people who are like, I had no idea how great strengths would be. I thought everyone was in a cult. I thought they were all crazy, etc. And I'm like, I know. I get why people resist this. But also, it is life-changing. Mm-hmm. Like it is a life-changing experience. And it's specifically because of the nuance involved in the test and just how specific and how accurate it is. And then, so I'll have people come in for the first time and I just so commonly hear like, oh, I wish I had done this 8 years ago or 10 years ago. I wish I had listened when everybody else had started doing it.
Right.
And I'm like, I know this will be my 20th year of like being a certified strengths coach. And I am now like, I wish that I had 10 more years of it, you know, just because it's been so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, I think strengths, knowing your strengths and knowing the Enneagram stuff, it gives you knowledge about yourself. It helps you understand yourself so much better. Yeah. And then you can do some of these things we've been talking about. When you get in these situations, you can go, oh, this is what I tend to do in these situations. And so you can recognize it and change your behavior.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, there's a control that you can only have when what the guidebook is, right? Like, you know, the instruction manual. And I feel a little bit sometimes like Enneagram and strengths are an instruction manual for me for how to treat myself and how to not treat myself. Like what do I not need to worry about? So I feel like that freedom or that control, the other thing that it does, which I think this is probably the most common thing we hear from authors on like their second or third time when we see them is, oh my gosh, I want everyone in my family to take this test because I had my spouse or partner take it. I had my kids and my parents take it. I had my boss take it. And now we understand each other in a way that we didn't used to. And I think for me, that is the biggest wish I'd known that we hear like eventually from people is I wish that I had had people take this 15 years ago. I wish my kids had had this when they were in high school. I wish I'd had this in college because it is such a translation tool for people to communicate about what they do and don't do. And it's amazing how many times partners, friends, and coworkers will end up with opposite strengths. And it's like, it will explain why we've never been able to communicate about this before because we're not even on the same page when it comes to how fast do we want to take action on something? How much do we need to think about something? How disciplined do we need to be? How much do you like to think? How much do you like to talk? Like it's mind-boggling sometimes how different we are from each other. Mm-hmm. And strengths can just help us have grace and attribute positive motivations to things we may not have done in the past.
Yeah, it helps you really see things from the other person's point of view, or it gives you more sympathy, empathy, you know, to, okay, this person likes to do things quickly. I don't, but that's how they're made. Speaking about like my spouse, he's ready to make a decision and go. And I'm like, no, I need to think about this for 3 days. And he's like, what are you thinking? Why? Yeah. Why? We can make this decision and go. So it helps you just communicate so much better.
Your spouse sounds like Jamie.
Yeah, I know. It's very common. A lot of the same things. It's very funny. Yeah. And then it is really funny how it works out. Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to say Crystal, who's my best friend, and Roland, who's my boyfriend, are very similar to each other. So it's no shock that like they all agree. We're like, whenever I say something like Crystal said this or Roland said this, they're like, oh, right. Of course. Yeah. And I'm like, no, no, this agreement is the wrong way.
Well, you've got a Kickstarter going. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So 7 years ago, technically 8, but 7 for the release. 7 years ago, I released the Dear Writer, You Need to Quit. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that book sort of launched the whole quit platform. Mm-hmm. And 7 years ago, 8 years ago, it was a different place. Mm-hmm. Publishing was a different place.
Yeah,
it really was. That book continues to help people and continues like tens of thousands, you know, I'm so grateful for how that has happened. But I feel like we need to have another sort of come to Jesus experience as like a full industry about the quitting, right? Like we need to really think about sustainability of our careers and how to narrow down and how to listen effectively and participate effectively because one of the things I think we also need to do is be more connected together and more relational with each other. And that's going to mean some friction. It's going to mean some pain. And so I wanted to do a more comprehensive book. The original Quit book had 20 chapters, I think 19 or 20. This one has 55 currently.
Oh, wow.
And I am still writing. So yeah, we'll see. There may be 100, I don't know. But for now, this is the what to question for 2025 and beyond.
Yeah, yeah. What I'm seeing, because even though I haven't been writing, I've still stayed in this community. I have a podcast, and then I'm in a room on every morning on Clubhouse. And then I just, I read, I'm in a lot of groups and I see what they're saying. What I see is there's always been a sense of franticness to this business, for the people who really wanted to do it well and make money at it and all of that. And what I see now is a heightened sense. There's more of that. Like it's higher because things have changed so much and people's incomes are going down, or the things that used to be working aren't working anymore. And I just feel like we've got to find a way to do what we need to do without it ruining our relationships and mental health and everything, our physical health and everything else. But I see people doubling down on that franticness, which scares me.
Yep. It's hard. It's hard to watch sometimes, because from an objective perspective, a lot of people's franticness is like, oh, I get why people, there are pretty consistent reports of people's royalties being down all over the industry. There are pretty consistent reports of it being harder to sell than it has been in the past, which again, like as we get farther and farther away from the end of the gold rush, that is literally what ends the gold rush, is when the blue water goes away. And that happened well before the pandemic. But now we start seeing the effects of the saturation point of the industry. And the problem is that people start to feel like the industry is closed when it's saturated. But there's a big difference between saturation and closure, right? Like there is always going to be openness to the market. There's always going to be readers looking for new books. There's always going to be opportunities for discovery. We could be 10 times more saturated than we are now, and there still will be the same level of need on the part of the readers. It's just the game changes. So every time the rules change in the larger publishing industry, right? We were in New York rules before 2010. We were in the gold rush rules up until, depending on who you ask, 17, 18, 19, 20, somewhere around there. I usually just say it the full decade, just because it's easier, because I don't think it really matters when it ended, but it's over. But the gold rush rules, and now we're in the golden age, which I say golden age because I have a particular reason why I say that. And everybody's like, but it's so hard, it's so saturated. I'm like, no, it was always hard. It's just that everybody thought it was easy. Like it's always been very hard to do this job. Right. But we all thought it was easier than it was. And so we all had this mentality about it's easier, it's easier, it's easier. And it's like, no, it was always difficult. It was just difficult in different ways than it is now. And when the rules change and the game changes, then you have to know what's hard and what's easy now, so that you know how to set your expectations for it. What's hard and what's easy 10 years ago was different. What's hard and what's easy now is different. But there still are, I still don't think there's a reason for us to not be hopeful about the future. And I'm pretty realistic about what I think is coming for the publishing industry. But the core for me is that we all still are readers. Readers still want to read books. There's always going to be openness. And there is no way that if we continue to build, that we aren't going to be able to build. I think people who are worried about that have a mentality that is, and then it doesn't help that when we use metaphors about it, like we use a real estate market metaphor, we use a lottery metaphor, we use a bank account metaphor, things like that, they really are are not capturing the full complexity of what it means to have an entertainment industry. It's just there are always going to be ways to be seen more, but the statistics are not, have not changed all that much in terms of the number of people who are making amounts of money and et cetera. Like it's still, it's very similar to what it's always been.
Yeah, well, that's, well, that's good news. Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't mean nothing changes.
You just have to do it different. Yep. Find a just new way to do it different.
More the same, but different, you know, like that, that saying about give me the same thing, only different. But you're very futuristic. So when you think about publishing in the future, what are you most hopeful for?
Oh, I mean, I am the most hopeful for us always being able to write no matter what. I'm not hopeful about everybody being able to be a full-time author, but I've never been hopeful about that. It was, the statistics were never great about the number of people who could be full-time authors. And this whole concept of like every single person out there who wants to do it can do it. It's like, no, that's never, this is not gardening where you have a gardening plot. This is a competitive entertainment industry, more similar to Hollywood, more similar to Nashville than it is similar to anything else. And every single other entertainment industry, it is a known quantity that it is very unlikely you're going to be able to do this for a living. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try because you never know who will and who won't. And the whole point of that is the excitement of being able to always know in the future things could change, because all entertainment industries by nature are very capricious, which means the luck could turn at any minute in a both a good and a bad direction, which if you're already making a lot of money is scary, right? Which is why I encourage people as much as possible, don't take on debt if you can help it. Be as frugal as you can possibly be. Watch your investments. Don't build a $1 million house because you make $1 million. Like I coach so many people who've gone through this of, okay, I'm going to be smart about how I'm doing this. And I watch them sort of build their smartness. And then I watch people who are like, who don't understand how capricious this industry is, and they just make different decisions. So people, when you understand it's capricious, you have the sort of, and I've seen her say this in public before, but I've never coached her, but I've seen Amanda Lee say this out loud in public before, that I'm going to make the hay while the sun is shining, because I never know when it's going to continue and when it's not. And she's been making buku money for a long, long time. And she still has the mentality that I think is the best mentality to have, which is, I have no idea if this is going to last or not, because this is a capricious industry, but I'm for sure going to work my tail off when I do get the luck and timing aligned. And make what I can, keep what I can, save what I can. But also, and I think this is really important, if it does go down, that is also not permanent. Like just because your income or royalties go down doesn't mean it's always going to stay that way. Right. There's just as much luck involved in like, well, I'm going to reinvent myself and try this all again, as there is in when you take off the first time. So like, I feel like we all get so, we think very predictably about the industry and we don't think about it as an entertainment industry. And then we get so caught up in the fact that what has happened in the past, so us not having success in the past means we won't have success in the future. And it's like, do you not understand what lotteries are? Like, you would never not buy a lottery ticket because you didn't win the last one. Like, what are you thinking? Keep writing, keep writing. There's always an opportunity in the future for you to do something different than what you've done in the past.
Well, that's awesome. That's a great answer. And I think we all need to take it to heart because, I mean, it's just, it's always been hard. It's always been hard. It's just a different kind of hard right now because there are things, because also there are things we don't understand. There are things happening that we don't understand and we can't see the future as to how those things are going to affect our future. And so that makes it hard too. And I get that. I get that. Tell us what you think the best thing you've done to set yourself up for success has been.
Ooh, stop caring about the money that I make.
Yeah.
I really have changed the way that I live. Like, I've changed how I spend money. I've changed how I make decisions. I am trying to be more conscious about longevity and sustainability than I am about the present moment. But you know what's weird is that it's actually allowed me to be more present with things that I really enjoy doing, because I'm not constantly just like in a fervor about this. I'm like, I am going to, especially as we look at the potential for economic changes in the United States, right? It's like we all need to be as ready for change as possible and as willing to change as possible. I don't want things to change, but I don't get a choice.
Right.
And so if there's something I don't have a choice about, I'm going to allow things to happen and I'm going to roll with it because I want to be in the best possible space that I can be. This is how I think about it. When you're in an airport and we have a coach, Jess Michaels, who used to give this example all the time. And I'm like, this is how I want us all to think about this. When you're in an airport and you have 6 or 7 flights in front of you, like you're going across the world and you have all these legs and you miss your first flight. And then you're like, oh my gosh, all of these flights are going to be impacted. And I can sit there and be mad about it. And I can wish it hadn't happened. And I can parse through how we got here. But if I don't get moving on rebooking those flights, I'm going to miss my opportunity to get more out of the future than I could have gotten if I wouldn't just accept what is happening. And I feel like a lot of what I want people to do is say, great, this is all happening. It's changing. We may not like it. And also, yes, we want to grieve. We want to be frustrated. If there's something I can personally do to change it, I sure want to change it, but there isn't. So then I'm going to practice the acceptance and I want to move as quickly as possible into how do I get the most out of the moments that I can in the future, which for me means being real clear about what I want. And then being real intentional about making it happen every day. Because if I have these goals about like, I'm only going to be happy when I make $1 million, guess what? You won't be. You will make $1 million and you'll say, I'll only be happy if I make 2 million. And then you'll make $2 million and you'll say, I'll only be happy if I make 4. And then you won't be happy when you make 4. So that is when I really got internalized about that. And I thought, what is the thing that I want out of my life, out of my day? And I do these values exercises with myself where I'm like, what are the things that I want every day? And then I go after those every day. I don't wait until I hit this magic space. Like, I have readers today who like what I'm doing. Let's write for them. There may be fewer of them than I wish there were, but if all I ever do is wait to feel that feeling when someday in the future, when I finally have enough readers, I'm never going to feel it because then I will have that thing happen and I still won't be present enough in that moment to be able to feel it. So I do a lot of practicing the feelings of what I want. I practice the significance. I practice the gratitude. I practice the validation. I practice the value. I practice love, right? Like I have these very intentional daily actions that I take trying to remind myself of what's already true about my life and about me so that I don't miss the moments when I'm in them that are giving me the things that I want just because it's not at the level that I think it should be or could be. It's, no, you have that today. Let's practice it.
Yeah. Because if we spend all our time thinking about the future, we miss what's going on right now. And I talked about that in an email I just sent to my list because my 34th book came out on Tuesday as we record this. And I was like, I need to go out and eat some Mexican food and just enjoy this for a little bit and be happy that, you know, because when I started writing, my dream was to write one book.
Yeah.
And maybe get it published if I could find a publisher. And I did that. But then now looking back now, that's huge, you know? And if you just keep focusing on the next book and the next thing, you don't celebrate those times and enjoy where you're at. So, so at least an hour, go to lunch and something for an hour. And I love the airline cancellation thing. I mean, it's like when your flight cancels, you rebook as soon as you can because everybody's scrambling, you know, you've got to rebook. And I love looking at it that way. That's really smart.
Yeah. It's such an easy metaphor to get your head around too. And I think about that now whenever something happens that I'm like, oh, I don't like this. I don't want this to have happened. I'm like, I'm going to miss my flight. I'm going to miss my flight. Mm-hmm. Like I almost out loud remind myself, like, got to get on a new plane, got to get on a new plane. Because mm-hmm. if I don't do that, I will get caught in the, oh, it should have been this way. It should have been this way. I wish this right. had happened. I wish that had happened. And then all I'm doing is just being later and later and mm-hmm. later for this future that I want to have happen. It's like, I can't get past that acceptance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I want that future to happen. And I believe that it's possible. Yeah. I believe it's possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We do too. Love it.
Yeah. I do too.
Love it. Well, where can people find out about the QuickCast, the Kickstarter, all, I mean, you have so much going on. Where's the best place to go to find those things?
BetterFasterAcademy.com/link okay. is the place. And also because we are doing a big like tour stop game for the Kickstarter, people who listen to this episode, mm-hmm. there's a little game that you can enter where we give away a specific prize on every stop. So we have a little personalized or individualized friendship bracelet that we're giving away that we made.
Ellen.
It's so fun. I'm so excited. I owe such an homage to Taylor Swift because so many of the things that she does are community building things, right? Yeah. And so they're very natural connectedness things for me to do. So we're doing these friendship bracelets. And interestingly, how I got into these, I'm not a Swiftie. I mean, I love what she does, but was not originally into this, mm-hmm. but I went to, I think it was Brian Cohen's conference in North Carolina, which was run by three women who are all Swifties. And they made these individualized friendship bracelets for that conference. And they had the little sayings on them. And I'm like, oh my gosh, we could put Loki is in charge and question the premise and all these things that I say all the time. I'm like, we're doing this. And so I have these friendship bracelets I got from Scarlett, you know, from the people at the conference. And now we're going to do that too. So I'm very excited.
Yeah, that is awesome. Very cool.
Yeah.
Well, we will have all those links in the show notes. And best of luck with the Kickstarter. Thanks for chatting with us today. It's always great to catch up.
Thank you so much for having me. And
you're welcome.
Just really, really glad to see this podcast has lasted almost, of these years.
Yeah.
It is such a great tool for writers. And I'm so grateful to the two of you for continuing to do it.
Well, I don't think we would be here doing this if it weren't for you, because you really helped us get started.
Well, first of all, when we told you the first title, you were like, try again.
You
said
it
much
title,
nicer,
though.
Nicer than
this
that.
This is a great title. I love it. Yeah.
Very good. Very good.
Thanks for listening today. You can support the podcast at wishidknownforwriters.com/support. And you can find the show notes at that same link. And we'll see everybody next week. Bye.